The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Rebecca Lavoie, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about Little Rumors Everywhere, episode 8 of the new season of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after the double homicide in 2002. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. If you haven't listened to the episode we're going to be talking about, pause this addendum podcast, go back and listen, and then come back and listen to this conversation. I promise it will make a whole lot more sense if you do. With us, as always, is Susan Simpson, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, the lawyer and super investigator and lead investigator from the Undisclosed team on this case. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rebecca.
We also have two guests today from the podcast Bound by Oath from the Institute for Justice. Now in its second season, it's exploring how government officials evade accountability through qualified immunity and other legal loopholes. John Ross is the editor and producer of Short Circuit, a weekly newsletter summarizing opinions from the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. He also produces Bound by Oath. Hey, John.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Anya Bidwell. She's an attorney with the Institute for Justice and their current Elfie Galoon Fellow in Freedom and the Constitution. Anya is one of the leaders of the Institute for Justice's project on immunity and accountability. Through this project, Anya works to promote judicial engagement and ensure that government officials are held to account when they violate individuals' constitutional rights. Anya, it's wonderful to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
That's a big lift, keeping government officials accountable. How did you decide to get into that particular line of work?
Well, actually, a lot of it has to do with my background, right? I was born and raised in a former Soviet Union country called Kyrgyzstan. And the judiciary is not independent, let me put it this way, right? And you never really expect to be able to turn to the judiciary when government does something bad to you, because the judiciary is in the pocket of the government. And this particular project is very appealing to me because that's exactly its goal, right? The goal is to basically say to the judiciary to kind of stay within its separation of powers mandate and enforce the Constitution against the government. That's sort of my background, my experience, and that's why I do it here all the time, because I'm petrified that one day the judiciary here is not going to be as powerful and as extraordinary as it is today.
John, can you tell me how the podcast Bound by Oath is tackling civil liability for government officials in the podcast? Like, what does the podcast aim to do and how is it made?
Sure. Well, big picture, when your rights are violated by the government and you want to sue, the legal avenues that you have to pursue are vary dramatically depending on what you're asking the government to do. That is, if you're asking for damages, if you're asking for money, then that dramatically changes what you want to do. If you are asking for an injunction, a court order saying stop what you're doing, that dramatically changes things. Another piece of the kaleidoscope is that if you're suing a state official versus a federal official, you have different legal avenues to pursue. All officials everywhere are entitled to qualified immunity, but some special officials get absolute immunity, which is what, you know, exactly what it sounds like, total bar to having to pay money damages or be accountable, even for extremely, extremely egregious misconduct. So to put this whole kaleidoscope in perspective, we're taking each episode focuses on a particular case, whether it's against state officials or local officials or federal officials or even municipalities. and really digging into each doctrine one by one and seeing how they shift and change. So there's, you know, stories from individual plaintiffs who are telling what happened to them, and a deep dive with scholars giving the history behind these doctrines. And so it's something that we hope that non-lawyers like myself will enjoy, but also, you know, first-year law students can sink their teeth into, and also something that lawyers who don't remember con law too well from back in school can dig into.
Yeah, if you like being appalled at how messed up our system is, this is a good podcast for you.
Oh, okay. So you can get a lot of rage going from it. I like those kinds of podcasts.
It's not a happy season, unfortunately. Our first season was about the 14th Amendment, and that's a happy, it's a happier story. Mm.
So let's talk a little bit about that whole civil liability conversation, because qualified immunity with police officers is one thing that's sort of in the front of a lot of conversations right now, political conversations. It's something that I know in my own state was a question in gubernatorial debates. Do you support qualified immunity for police officers? And depending on who's being backed by the police union, it really seems to influence the answer. And it does seem like a real lightning rod issue. There is so much fear, I think, that political figures have of being maligned by police unions and police. But qualified immunity in so many ways doesn't make sense, given the fact that these governmental employees carry guns and, you know, have all the authority. Anya, what do you think of the fact that this conversation is so in the forefront right now? Do you have hope that maybe there'll be some change down the road?
Absolutely. I always have hope. And one thing to say about qualified immunity is that it not only shields police officers, right? And generally, we think police officers, split-second decisions, they need qualified immunity. First of all, they don't. Already, when you talk about Fourth Amendment, there is a reasonableness protection, right, within it, where the Supreme Court specifically says, even if we don't even talk about qualified immunity, if an officer acted reasonably, which is a very generous standard, then no liability is going to happen. But qualified immunity doesn't just shield police officers. Qualified immunity shields any and every government worker, no matter what. It can be your mayor, it can be your police officer, it can be your IRS agent, Bureau of Land Management folks, right? As long as you work for the government, qualified immunity shields you. And the idea is that, you know, supposedly it puts an officer or an official on notice that what they're doing violates constitutional rights. Though it really, if you look at the doctrine itself and you listen to our season, you'll see that the test itself has nothing to do with whether a government worker is actually put on notice. If that were the case, overcoming qualified immunity would have been much easier. At this point, qualified immunity protects any government worker, even when they act with a bad intention.
Right.
That's the key.
I've actually seen it used in cases like sexual harassment cases. Like, it's used in other ways and in like civil cases that normally at any other kind of job, you know, would be of concern. You know, I don't know how successful it is in those kinds of cases, but I see it cited all the time. Also, the privilege of communications and the privilege of disciplinary records of government employees, there seems to be a lot of times these things are sealed in a way they're not sealed with, you know, non-government employees, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's definitely a double standard when it comes to accountability for, you know, anybody other than government workers, right? When it comes to accountability to government workers, they have a much, it's much more difficult to hold them to account than anybody else who is not working for the government. And to your point about bad intent, there was a case out of Fresno in California where police officers went into someone's house to search, right? And they stole some money. That's at least what the complaint alleges, that these police officers stole money. And
I think it was from a business. I think it was from a business and not a home, but sorry, go ahead.
It's from a business, but they went into the private homes of those who own the business. And the defense was that it's qualified immunity applies. And the Ninth Circuit, right? We think about Ninth Circuit, California, like these guys, they're really with it. The Ninth Circuit said, yeah, even though these guys allegedly stole something, qualified immunity protects them, and we stop any kind of discovery from going forward. We just stop it in its tracks and the case is dismissed.
Yeah, we're not talking about just having like a little bit of a higher bar here for certain kinds of misconduct or like, oh, you know, it's the government, so we'll let this whole like minor civil claim go. No, we're talking like up to and including murder. You're barred. You still can't get any kind of remedy against it. And in many cases, there's not going to be any kind of criminal remedy that's enforced either. So you'll have essentially no civil, no criminal, no penalties of any sort. I guess you can hope that there's some kind of career penalty, but I mean, that's if that happens, that's it.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's like with prosecutions, right? It's hard to actually get a prosecutor to have to launch a case against a fellow police officer. Those guys work with each other. And so it's really, it's up to an individual to file a constitutional claim and to say what was done to me was wrong. And that's prevented by qualified immunity very often.
In the Sergio Hernandez case, there was never any criminal liability, right?
Hernandez is a very interesting case. For those who don't know, basically a Border Patrol agent shot and killed a non-threatening Mexican teenager. Sergio was 15 years old at the time. He shot him across the border, right? And the kid was just playing the game of chicken and going from one side of the culvert of the border to another side of the culvert. And this agent basically shot and killed him. And the family of Sergio, they couldn't file a lawsuit in state court because a Customs and Border Protection officer is a federal official. And the way the law works today is you can't sue federal officials in state courts for violations within the scope of their employment. So they couldn't file in the state court. There was not any other, the prosecution never charged CBP officer, right? So the only real way to hold them accountable was by filing a civil rights lawsuit in a federal court alleging violations of constitutional rights. It was either that or nothing. There was no other route to accountability. And the court still said, first, the Fifth Circuit said that qualified immunity applies, right, and shields this official. And the Supreme Court actually said, you know what, this is just too much for us to even swallow. You know, let's just, qualified immunity doesn't apply. And then what the government did was basically said, well, if qualified immunity doesn't apply, then we have another idea for you. Because this guy is a federal official, then you can't sue him in the first place, right? So we don't even have to talk about qualified immunity. And guess what? That actually, you know, the Supreme Court agreed with that. It said, yes, you're right. Because he's a federal officer, you can't sue him for violations of constitutional rights. So too bad, Sergio, and your family. You have no rights for your, no recourse, even when your rights were violated.
John, I have a question for you as a non-lawyer, something that I wonder about all the time when it comes to issues like this. We all hear about cases all the time where, you know, prosecutors can't be held accountable, police can't be held accountable, other government officials. I wonder if people who have these jobs, once they sort of get in it and find out that they can get away with stuff, if they start sort of behaving worse and worse and worse, or if people who are kind of inclined to behave unethically are attracted to these kinds of jobs because they know they'll be shielded. Do you find yourself wondering about the kinds of people that do this work and how they feel about how they're being shielded?
Yeah, all the time. And I do try and avoid the temptation to psychoanalyze like an entire profession full of many individuals, most of whom I don't know. But I do feel I have a fair amount of expertise in reading these opinions. And they're just, you know, it's a few opinions a week as I'm going through. You know, you mentioned in my bio, I put together a newsletter every week where I read federal circuit court opinions, federal appeals court opinions, and we put out a little newsletter. And there's just shocking police and prosecutor and prison guard misconduct every week. So this stuff it's happening a lot, and there's often no remedy. So knowing that, you know, you'd have to think certainly people could get into these professions and get away with things, and the remedies might not be there.
It is bad enough that this happens, that these injuries, these constitutional violations happen with no remedy. But just to make it worse, they also make it the most Orwellian thing imaginable. It's denied, not just like, sorry, we can't. It's denied because of the most insane Mother May I rules you've ever imagined. And there's not like a rule that says you can never have, theoretically, you should be able to have remedies for these violations. There's a long history in the U.S. where, yes, people who will have their rights violated can get civil remedies. And that is slowly grinding to a stop. There's a few limited cases right now where you can still occasionally bring a suit. But even those are getting picked away at to the point where, I mean, right now, what can an officer do that will get them sued? And successfully. Like, what conduct would it take for them to do to actually face liability in our courts?
I don't know, because it doesn't seem like it often gets there. It very much seems like when a municipality believes that a lawsuit could be successful, they end up settling, and then we don't hear about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, too. It's basically limited to like extreme police violence, and even then, you don't always win.
Yeah. It depends on whether or not it's caught on camera or not, right?
Well...
There was a recent case the United States Supreme Court basically didn't even hear an oral argument on, but they reversed the Fifth Circuit, right? And we look at it as a very good sign, Taylor versus Riojas. And there you had an inmate basically alleging violations of his constitutional rights because he was stuck in a cell with like feces stuffed into the faucet. And, you know, it was just horribly egregious things happening. And sure enough, the government said qualified immunity protects us. And the Supreme Court actually, without even hearing the oral argument, said, you know what? There are just certain things where it is obviously unconstitutional. And just looking for a specific case that will match the exact situation that is at issue here is not gonna, you know, get you there. So that was really encouraging to hear that at some point there is a thinking where the Supreme Court is, you know, kind of drawing the line. And another kind of, I want to have some good news going here, right? So another really positive sign from the Supreme Court was in this case, Tanvir versus Tanzeen, where people alleged violations of their religious rights. And again, the United States Supreme Court unanimously actually said that you should be able to sue for damages when your constitution is violated, when your constitutional rights are violated. And just like Susan said, you know, there is a history of suing for damages in this country. And that's a storied history, and we kind of are still standing by that history and endorsing it. So, you know, it's encouraging to hear from the court say things like that, because that gives us as lawyers an opportunity to then take this case and use it to make our own arguments to the Supreme Court.
So right now, under the current regime with current QI standards, the problem of qualified immunity, the... major hurdle is this idea that for any case to come forward and successful, it must match a previous case almost to a T, to the point, not quite, but almost, where like, oh, the officer wore a green shirt while tasing someone to death. Well, we've only seen cases where they wore a blue shirt and did that. So this doesn't fall underneath it. If the facts don't match perfectly, then something that seems like to you and I, like an obvious constitutional violation, without having to even think about it. Nope. Not clear enough for purposes of qualified immunity.
You know what that makes me think of, Susan? I mean, it makes me think of what's happening right now in prisons around the country with the pandemic. There's some reporting from my newsroom at NHPR this week about, you know, huge, huge outbreaks in correctional facilities where it is, as it turns out, inmates were not allowed to wear masks for security reasons for months during the pandemic. And, you know, if you were an alien coming from Mars, you would say, how is this different from other prison condition cases? But the pandemic is going to be seen probably as a unique situation and is going to have to like face a whole new series of tests, right?
Likely. Yeah. I wouldn't. It's a hard world out there for plaintiffs like lawyers.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things we talk about on the podcast is that this doctrine of qualified immunity makes it very difficult to ask a good question of the courts and get an answer on these kinds of things, because you have to have a prior court ruling that's close, right? And if that's never come up before, you know, we haven't had a pandemic in so long, you know, there's not a whole lot of doctrine out there for courts to base their decisions on. And there's kind of a circuit split in as to how precisely on point these cases have to be. We talk about one case out of Connecticut where prison officials had knowingly allowed prisoners to be exposed to radon gas for many years. They built a prison on top of a place that was leaking radon gas, which is a carcinogen. And the lawyers, the jail's lawyers said, well, listen, there's no precedent about radon gas. There's precedent about secondhand smoke exposing prisoners to that kind of carcinogen, but there's nothing on radon. And so that's not, you know, it's not close enough to put us on
notice. And
that
sounds like a silly argument, but trust me, in the QI world, that is actually, it's pretty reasonable.
It's completely reasonable.
Yeah.
But the Second Circuit said no. The Second Circuit rejected that argument. And, you know, so there's so many other cases that go the other way, right, where that would have been reasonable and that would have won the day. So as a civil rights plaintiff, you just have no idea going forward, going into your cases, what facts courts are even going to rely on and look at. And when you've got, you know, potentially years of legal fees ahead of you, this makes things very daunting for, you know, civil rights lawyers themselves to bring because they don't know if they're going to get paid. It makes it daunting for plaintiffs to fund if they even can. So in some sense, the problem is not that plaintiffs are losing so much. It's just that there's chaos in the courts and people don't know how to proceed or if they can proceed or what's going to matter at the end of the day in these cases.
Wow, it's really fascinating. I'm definitely going to be checking out your podcast. I have a lot of questions. Like I want to know, for instance, how would I go about suing my town official? But I do want to talk a little bit about this week's episode of Undisclosed. So, Susan, one question that came up in this week's episode is whether Jim Bennett and Doug Estes were strangers to one another, or if there could have been a connection between them that might explain their meeting in the game area that day. Now, we met Gary Crumble, Doug's cousin and a friend of Bennett's, from the bar. He says they didn't know one another. But does that prove that? I mean, couldn't they have been connected in some other way?
It is really hard to prove a negative like this of two people not knowing one another. Unless you have someone come forward to say that I was in a room with them both, or like Doug told me about Jim and Jim told me about knowing Doug. Like, how do you ever prove that? I mean, it's not hard to think that you have two friends that you have no idea that know one another that happen to, you know, hang out once in a while. In this case, there's absolutely no proven connection between the two men. I think that if that existed, we'd know about it. But the more I've worked on this case, the more I've realized that there are so many overlapping connections between these two men's circles. Like, there's one woman who once tried to date Jim Bennett and then later was talking about how she was being accused of having an affair with Doug Estes, falsely accused. Nothing that wasn't the situation, but just the idea that this one woman had these ties to both was surprising to me. You've got another uncle that I think owned a bar, that uncle of Doug Estes, who also knew Jim Bennett. There's a guy who was friends with the Estes family, but he moved between the drug scenes in both Comstock and Leonidas, and separately knew drug dealers in both those worlds. And interestingly, knew Skeeter Cerny too, which I can only assume is a coincidence. And you also have, let's see, I mean, just all these like secondhand connections where like it almost seems surprising that they wouldn't have known one another. On the other hand, if they did know one another, it was been fleeting. It would have been like that guy they saw a couple times here and there. And it seems to me that they could have been the sort of fleeting acquaintance that if you ran into in the woods by chance, you might say hello to or chat to for a second.
Why does this matter in terms of the case and the prosecution's case and whether or not Titus was culpable or not? Like, what does the state say about their relationship?
The state says there was none and that okay. It was just chance and they're both there hunting that day and nothing to do with anything else. But one of the persistent rumors, investigations going on in this case has to do with drug-related angles and all these suggestions coming from all kinds of sources that are, I would argue, less than credible, that the two men had some kind of connection in the drug world and somehow, some way, this was related, their meeting that day was related to some kind of drug nexus.
Yeah, if you told me two drug dealers meet in the woods and wind
and both
up
get
dead,
killed.
And wasn't one of the stepson was like living with someone who had connections to a Chicago cartel,
yes.
And he was on the scene. I just I struggle.
It's
so
the plot of Ozark,
with,
right? I mean, 100%. Yeah. This is what's going on here.
How do you turn a blind eye to that? I mean, I guess they did the, you know, none of the leads panned out, but I would have to think that, you know, this is something that's very, very, very suspicious unless you have blinders on and you want to get Jeff Titus.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, I sent Susan, I was emailing, you know, when the episode was finished, I always send a note about, like, you know, technical stuff about the episode. And I was, by the way, I totally think this is drug related. I mean, I don't want to be one of those people who hears drugs and is like, all of a sudden, that's it. But it sounds like we're not talking about, you know, just guys who grow for their own use. I mean, there's a larger potential organizational connection here, right?
Look, Rebecca, a doper would shoot a man in a shitter, but would not shoot a redneck in the woods.
A doper. I love that. Who was that guy who was saying, like, I was a cop. I know dopers. I know how they are. I know what they are. I'm like, how you do?
Yeah, that's right. I know their heart.
I know
right?
their heart.
Yes. That's Mike Brown. He was undercover. He was the undercover, like, sting guy for the dopers way back in the 60s. Hmm. And he kind of made me think of y'all's case and Brownback, and that Brown told us about how he'd, you know, grow his hair out, get all scruffy and look all, I guess, dopery. I don't know, which is exactly what happened. The undercover guys in another Michigan case, the Brownback case, where.
That's exactly how those guys look like.
Talk about that.
That was the thing. So James, he had no idea that those were law enforcement officers, right?
Well, wait. Anya, can you just tell me about the Brownback case? Because I don't know about the case. So give me the thumbnail sketch and then tell us this juicy story.
Sure. But that's a great connection. So James King, the U.S. Supreme Court actually just heard his case in November. My colleague Patrick argued it. James King was an innocent college student in 2016 walking during the day, right? It was daylight, walking from one place of work to another place of work. And these two scruffy looking guys walk up to him and they say, "What's your name?" Right? And he kind of says, "James," and goes on his way. And then they basically say, "Put your hands to the car and turn to us with your back." At first, he looked at some sort of, they had laminate something, some sort of a thing of authority that he thought maybe they had.
Yeah, they're wearing badges around their necks.
That's right, laminate badges.
But they were scruffy looking.
They were scruffy looking and they went for his wallet, right? Like, imagine yourself in that situation where scruffy looking guys all of a sudden take a wallet from you. What do you think? So he just started running, right? Because he thought he was being robbed. And they ran after him, they tackled him, and they started beating him horribly, chokeholding him, to the point where bystanders watching all this happening say, "Call the police, call the police." And we even have like this audio recording where a woman says, they're killing him, come, right? Little did they know that these were the police. Right. They were actually members of a federal state task force. They actually prosecuted James because they were for resisting arrest, because what they wanted him to do is to give them a guilty plea, because once he pleads guilty, then it would be really hard for him to sue them. Right. Then they'd say probable cause existed. He pled guilty. So but he refused to plead guilty because he said they did nothing wrong. And they took it all the way to trial and unanimous jury acquitted James. But his parents went into bankruptcy and the stress of this whole situation, right? And so he then says, "Well, I gotta sue them for violating my constitutional rights." So the whole prosecution and trial, when the officers wanted it, took 9 months. And now it's taking James 6 years to even get the officers to answer his complaint, because they essentially say, "You can't sue us." And they use a whole bunch of doctrines. Qualified immunity is just one of them, right? Whole bunch of doctrines and the way they interact with each other. And the result of it is they basically say, "You can't sue us. No matter what you do, no matter how you try, no matter how unreasonably we behaved, you can't sue us."
In the James King case, he wasn't convicted, but I mean, in some ways he got like that was not a guaranteed outcome. Like, he rolled the dice and happened to win this time. But what amazed me was the detective was so appalled when the jury acquitted him. He could not comprehend why the jury would possibly have not found this guy guilty, obstructing his, trying to arrest him.
Thinking that they were going to rob him. Right. Somehow that's an offense.
And of course, the jury is like, oh, we didn't think the cops were lying. We just thought that, you know, there were some issues here. When I would say there's a very, very strong inference that is raised by the by their testimony that, yes, these cops were lying on the stand about what happened to try to make this kid look guilty of a crime he never did.
John, I've heard so many times in criminal justice stories in the last few years, I think a lot of about the Curtis Flowers case, for instance, and other cases like that, wrongful conviction cases, where the person with all the power just refuses to respond to a motion, to a subpoena, to, you know, grand. I mean, it's really incredible to me that there is this, you know, sort of set of people who, like the cops in this case, who believe that a non-response is fine. In any other situation, that would not be fine, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an interesting thing about this case, which is that we just had a Supreme Court argument, but it's still at a very, very preliminary level of the case. The question confronting the court, stripped of legalese, is like, is this even something you can go to trial on?
Because they're basically saying that the two, because he dared to bring different claims in one lawsuit, which is a very typical situation for a lawyer to do, right? I'm not worth my salt as a lawyer if I just pick one claim and just go with it. You bring several different claims. One of them was for violations of his constitutional rights, and another one was for violations of essentially state torts, right? And they're basically saying that because we dared to bring several different claims and we lost on one of them on procedural grounds, that somehow those two claims cancel each other out and our constitutional claim is completely, is made to disappear.
Yeah, there's a different procedural bar, not qualified immunity, in this case, in the Brownback case. I mean, there's just so many bars that effectively you have only the tiniest fraction of misconducts of constitutional violations can result in civil remedies. And civil remedies aren't the end-all and be-all. Like, there are other ways of policing the government. But a lot of time, there is nothing else. So this stopgap.
Yeah.
And you're right, Susan. Ordinarily, you know, a complaint would be filed and police officers would have to answer the complaint. They'd have to, you know, go to court and testify. They'd have to give a deposition. But none of that has happened yet. And we're going on 6 years since the actual incident. They've never had to explain, you know, why the heck they decided to beat this kid up.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, back to the Titus case. Susan, in this episode, we hear for the first time about some other suspects that were investigated. It seems like this was a case where there have been a lot of leads. And I'm wondering how many suspects have actually been considered and are there others that you're hearing about now?
So this case has had so many suspects. One thing I will say about the investigation, especially for the original investigators, but also for the cold case team, is that even when the cold case team was dead focused on Jeff Titus, even when they were certain they knew who it was, they did have all these other leads keep coming in. And it seems like they felt they couldn't just totally brush all these off because they had people coming to them saying, hey, I know who did it. Here's how they did it and why they did it. And I mean, I've seen some cases where the officers involved and like, yeah, we don't care, and just shut it down, never look into it. Here, they did look into it. Like, in a lot of these possible suspects, we've got a record there. Unfortunately, a lot of them are just, like, the most mind-numbing nonsense you've ever seen in your entire life. Hmm. There are an extraordinary number of people who have what, on their face, seem like very good leads that never came to anything for good reason. We're not going to talk about the case, but there's another guy named Chuck Lombard who the cops spent, I mean, at least 2 months trying to check out. He was a friend of the Estes family. He had a very elaborate story about how this is all a hit done by Bobby's uncle for various reasons. And he had what seemed like supporting evidence in some ways. End of the day, from what all I've seen and what the cops saw back then, he was in prison on their charges and he just wanted to cut a deal. Hmm. All that effort and time and investigation went into the story that like makes you want to tear your hair out. And you had, I mean, another one, I can't think about a lot in this case. There was a teenager who was very emotionally disturbed. Lived close to the killings, had been hunting that day, and he convinced himself he was responsible for the murders.
Oh my God!
Yeah, it is a heartbreaking interview to read because this kid just he convinced himself, like he seems to have fully believed he murdered them for reasons that don't make any kind of sense. But he confessed, like he told people around town, and they like, oh my God, it was this kid's kid. We gotta go tell the police. They tell the police. He confesses, but he can't get any of the details right. Like, he is way off on some important stuff. And thankfully, in this case, the original detectives, Warsima and Ballot, they were absolutely not just trying to solve this case and move on. They were very careful. They were methodical. They weren't looking for an aggressive solution. And they do talk to this kid. And there's some other stuff going on, too, with this kid's father, who also knew Bennett and, like, had some other problematic issues and a shaky alibi. So there's a lot going on with it. And they interview the kid. And the kid's like, I did it. Like, I'm sorry about it, but I did it. I am very certain that a different set of detectives could have gotten that kid in prison for life, no problem.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm listening to the story, and I'm like, a Doug Evans would be all over this, right? He'd be like, oh, we have someone saying he did it. Let's put him in prison forever.
Despite- and he truly believed he did it. Like, the way he was in his mindset, he actually thought he had done it because people told him he did it. He got afraid he'd done it, so he decided he had done it. Stuff like that. But he just didn't know any details.
Well, we also heard about a witness, Dan Israels, who testified about a discussion he'd had with Titus a couple of weeks after the murders. How did prosecutors try to use this at trial?
They used it the same way. I mean, at a certain point, the Titus trial just became a kind of mind-numbing litany of the same, I heard Titus say this, I heard Titus say this, over and over again. And I guess at a certain point, you add it all together, and it seems like it must be substantial.
Remind us what Dan said he heard Titus say.
Yeah. So Dan Israels says that while at Fort Custer, waiting out there for a hunt, Titus said stuff that made him uncomfortable and made him think the guy was guilty. For instance, he said that he found the gun 41 yards away from where the bodies were instead of the 23 feet the newspaper said, which for some reason made Dan Israels think that this was suspicious. I don't know. And he heard that Titus would talk about guns, but he wasn't consistent what kind of gun he talked about. Like, he named three kinds of guns. And just things like that. The one part of what he says that could be legit, I think, like, factually could be considered evidence, is he says that Titus heard the gunshots at 4:30 that afternoon, when Titus should have been, of course, at the Shepherd Farm, 27 miles north, where his alibi is. And I mean, the whole story just doesn't seem like really that big a deal. Like, I mean,
yeah, that seems like a detail you could misremember a few years on.
Yeah, and he, of course, could. I think Titus probably just said the shootings happened at 4:30, as people heard, and he, Dan Israels, might have heard it as him saying, "I said 4:30," but given every, like, just in general context, I don't find that significant. What to me is notable is that Dan Israels felt compelled to go call the police about this encounter, which otherwise doesn't even seem that important at all. But something about it made him think it was.
Well, the same with Jeff Titus's coworkers, right? A lot of people felt like this is a guy who's really weird, and it adds up to maybe just bad social skills, right?
Rather than evidence.
And
that's really what it was. And it's, to me, what's also interesting for this example is that so Dan Israels had a girlfriend. She was there for this conversation as well. Back in 1990, and the police interviewed her. She didn't say too much. Then again, in 2001-ish, when the cold case came out in the case, they talked to Dan Israels' girlfriend and asked her about, you know, this whole thing. And she tells them, oh, yeah, I remember that. There's this guy who's really cocky and bragging about all the deer he could shoot on his block permit, which is a permit that farmers get, lets them take more deer than an average hunter could. And they don't call her at trial, obviously, because that's nothing important. Well, when I went to talk to her to see what she remembered, you know, she comes to the door, we talk. She's like, oh, you know, I don't really remember that. Like, that was so long ago. She's like, I remember being out there at Fort Custer. And I think he said something like, oh, yeah, like, oh, I killed those two guys. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. Like, like 30 years later, your memory has been so transformed that you've gone from having an extremely non-incriminating memory of events to, like, the most incriminating, even way more than anything Dan Israels ever said.
Right.
And she wasn't, like, it wasn't, like, a lie. Like, she was, like, straying to remember anything. And she's like, yeah, I had, there's a conversation. I heard something. I think he admitted to killing people. I'm like, no, that's not okay.
Yeah. Well, we did hear over and over again, and we've heard it in other episodes too, about how he brings suspicion on himself by the things he says. You know, that whole conversation he had about, you know, if I came across drug dealers, I would kill them, you know.
He didn't actually say that. He never said that in particular. The problem was, is he was talking, he never said, like, I would kill them. It was, I'm paraphrasing here.
If two druggies die, you know, so what?
Yeah.
No skin off my back. That's what it was.
Insufficient reverence for human life, I guess.
I'm curious what your guys' impressions are of Jeff Titus, you know, after sort of hearing all these stories about him and how he just kind of is in his interviews, even with Susan. Anya, do you have an impression of this guy that is, you know, do you understand why people say, you know, he's in prison because of things he said?
It's very interesting. And my husband is not going to appreciate me saying that, but there was like this point in one of the episodes where his wife basically says, and he strikes up conversations with strangers all the time. And I'll be like standing outside of the supermarket, you know, with our children waiting for him. And he's just talking to these guys. And that's exactly what Brett does. So it's like, yeah, I get that.
See, now next time you can tell him this is how you go to prison for life or murder. So don't do that.
But Susan, is he, I mean, he's not, he's just sort of like talking out of like one side of his mouth, right? I mean, he just like likes to talk. It's not that he likes to be inappropriate. I don't think he knows that he's inappropriate. We've heard that over and over again, right?
He is a very friendly guy, a very talkative guy. And I mean, he doesn't seem to get the ebb and flow of conversations, put it that way. And he loves to talk. He's very friendly. Yeah.
I have theories, as I've said before on the show, about what's going on with Titus that I think puts him at a disadvantage.
I'm just thinking about kind of like, he doesn't seem to be able to read other people's cues.
Read the room. Right. Yeah.
Right. He doesn't seem to be able to read the room, and he'll insist on a particular line of a conversation and he has something to say. There's definitely something going on there that he's not just, he has a very distinct way of being, which could have potentially gotten him into trouble.
And not to pile on the guy, I mean, he does seem to have good friendships with substantial people who, you know, if you're not rubbed wrong by his style, then, you know, great. You might have something in common. His one friend in Lansing, what's his name? Stan Driscoll. Mm-hmm. Seems like you're right. You mentioned this on the podcast that it seems like an odd pairing, but you know, he's obviously appealing to some people if they're hunting together.
If they have shared interest, and you appreciate Jeff's real skill at what he does. Jeff Titus has a certain emotional inaccessibility, let's put it that way. He is very hard to get emotional reactions out of. I know Jacinda, for the her documentary, you know, would try to have emotional conversations with him. And he, you know, he'll acknowledge stuff can be sad, but he's going to transition to talking about something kind of happier. Like he doesn't really do the emotion thing.
Has he ever been examined by a psychiatrist or psychologist by a defense team?
I think he should have been. Yeah,
I agree.
I think that would have been an intelligent decision for attorneys to make.
I agree.
He has an interesting level of self-awareness too, where if you ask him, he can tell you that like, oh, they thought that was inappropriate, or like that made them uncomfortable. I shouldn't have said that. Or like, I talk about hunting too much. Like he'll tell you this awareness that he somehow doesn't seem to quite have internalized. Like, even, like, the story about the security system at his house. He does not get why that is something others are going to be like, okay, what the hell is going on here? Right. To him, it makes total sense. Like, it's a great idea.
Right. To him, it's the same as putting a sign on your yard that says you have a security system when you actually don't. That's the same thing as telling people your house is strung up with bombs. Like, to him, it's like, it works, right? So why not keep doing it? Yeah, I keep finding myself thinking over and over again, if only we had like Olivette from Law and Order come in and examine him, we may have had a very different result here. Because there is something about explaining how somebody is. I mean, affects get held against people all the time, defendants in cases. Like, I wouldn't act that way if my loved one had just been murdered. Or, you know, for someone who says they're innocent, they don't seem very upset. We hear that over and over again, right?
But at the same time, like, the stuff Titus says is weird. But I've heard a lot of weird stuff over there in Kalamazoo. Just saying. Like, people say
he's not
some
alone,
really,
what you're saying?
Really weird things. And, I mean, Titus's problem is he's talkative. I had one person tell me who lived in the area, and they're like, you know what? I'm kind of weird, too, but I'm weird and quiet. You can't be weird and talkative like Titus is. That's his problem. But people, well, like Gary Krimble, like, had no problem, like, telling an emotional, like, description of how he would have, like, murdered and skinned Titus alive, which, again, the kind of thing you could later use in some kind of criminal trial, like that dude's really creepy.
Right.
But unless you're looking at that context, you're not going to think it's like evidence that they're a murderer.
Right. So we also hear about this guy, Norberto. Would you mind pronouncing his last name for me, Susan, for the definitive pronunciation?
Agonesis. But you can call him Nerve.
Say it again. Oh. I missed that.
Agonesis. But you can call him Nerve.
Nerve. Okay. So this guy, Nerve, Norberto, he made some claims about this case that would make him a critical witness if those claims are true. Can you just remind us of his significance in this case?
Oof. Well, to narrow down on a few of the topics, one of the stories he's given is that Jim was, you know, a customer or someone involved in his trade, and that Jim Bennett came by his house at times, which is why he's sure that Bobby Brown, Doug's stepson, must have known him. And that, in fact, that day, Doug and Bobby had been going down to the Fulton Game area in order to rip off Jim Bennett's marijuana crop. And that seems like a big deal, right? Like, that seems like a real huge deal. The defense thought it was. The defense put him on the stand, made him, like, the centerpiece of one of their defenses. And the problem is, I just don't think it's true.
Right. I have a question. This is something I kept thinking about. Isn't ripping, if for instance, there is somebody who's like a minor drug kingpin, so much so that he has this big marijuana crop, which we've established it wasn't the season where it would have been rip-offable anyway, couldn't it just be money? I mean, in another possible theory, if you know that somebody has a lot of money because they've just done a deal, couldn't that be a motive potentially?
Yeah, but if Bennett has, well, yeah. That in fact has been an allegation that was made, and there was no money left in the wallet. So right. If you known, for instance, foreshadowing that Bennett supposedly had a $500 deal he'd done that afternoon during his right after his nap, maybe someone was going there for the money in his wallet. There's a lot of, it all falls into the quote-unquote drug theory, but really these possible allegations and these suspicions and these, all kinds of claims being made cover kind of the gamut of possible reasons of why these two men could end up together and how they ended up getting shot.
Right. But he's a problematic witness, right? Because he's kind of all over the place. You described him in your notes as a potential fabulist. So he knows a lot of things that are true, but then he says a bunch of other things that don't necessarily kind of go with any particular narrative. Can you just talk about that sort of problematic witness? Because he ended up being somebody that wasn't used, right?
I mean, he was by the defense at trial, not by the prosecution. They knew they couldn't. And he was, he's a great storyteller. He's fantastic. We had probably a 2-hour conversation with him. It was a very entertaining man. And he's troubling because, I mean, there's a lot of witnesses that lie to me. I'm used to that. But I don't often encounter witnesses who seem to be lying for reasons I just cannot begin to fathom. There's no personal gain for it. There's no strategy. There's nothing in it. In fact, they're harming themselves by telling the story, and yet they seem to be enjoying telling it anyway. And I don't know if that's what's going on here. Certainly there's people, investigators find him credible. They just believe that he's useless as a witness because of his, he'd be impeached on the stand for sure. But it doesn't add up. I will note there's another cold case in Kalamazoo, a pretty tragic one, that back in 2000 when he was interviewed, he's like, oh, by the way, I know what happened to that woman, Joyce. And he gave a very detailed, comprehensible, direct account that makes sense about how he knows who kills this woman. And from what I can find of the facts, it actually seems to match pretty well, really well. And when we talked to him, he kind of buried his head in his hands. And then it was the only time in our interview where he was able to give a story that matched exactly what he'd said every time before. His other stories, they changed and adapted all over the place. This one was full on exactly the same to an astonishing degree. Maybe I just fell for Norberto once again, but I kept thinking this story is real. He knows what happened to that woman. And I think the cops heard him, maybe think he's right, but know that they can never use him as a witness because he's just, again, a defense attorney would tear him apart in the stand. So despite him having all this information, they dropped the case and never. It's still cold today.
But just because somebody's a bad witness doesn't mean, it's not like fruit from a poisonous tree. Just because you can't put him in a stand, they still could investigate those leads, right?
They could, and I can't get the file because it's still open, so I don't know how far they took it. But at the same time, if your main witness is a guy that you're not going to be able to use, there's the temptation to keep moving. That's the kind of, the approach is you got to find an angle that's going to work in court. If Norberto's never going to hold up, keep looking until you find one that will work.
Hmm. Really interesting. So he, just to clarify, he was the person that that Brown was living with, the stepson?
Yes, he was. He lived close by, and the yeah.
I have questions. John, I found myself wondering, and I'm not going to ask you to speculate, but I found myself wondering whether or not, like, isn't Norberto himself in the frame, given his, like, kind of tie to this kid who apparently had this, like, previously terrible relationship with his stepdad, who ended up being the victim of a murder? To me, that puts him in the frame in many ways. Did you find yourself thinking the same thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's certainly someone to be followed up on. It seems like there's more there. You know, if in the drug trade, there's going to be a lot of folks who are not going to tell police the truth.
You mean the dopers?
The dopers. So I wouldn't expect, you know, very reliable answers. And it seems like that would be a plausible thing to look into. But then again, I mean, if he has an alibi that checks out, then he's got an alibi. So, I mean,
he has no, he's an anti-alibi. His alibi is he's the one person on earth who could have killed them.
What?
Because no one else knew where to find Doug Estes.
Huh.
So Norberto, like, if Norberto's stories are, like, that's the thing. If his stories are true, that someone would have wanted to kill Doug Estes, by his own account, he is the one person who could have tipped him off.
Hmm.
But, of course, so the counterpoint to that is that both Bobby and Mark Perry, who was not part of that circle, both say that they never stopped by Norberto's. They never told him they're doing this. They didn't know they're doing it themselves or they're going themselves.
Right.
And that he's God knows why he's saying it. Same reason he said he knew Jim Bennett and now says, oh, no, I never knew that guy.
Hmm.
Well, it's possible Doug Estes knew where he was going and even pretended he didn't.
Yeah, that part. And even Bobby says it's weird. They didn't really know where they just kind of ended up there.
Yeah, that's to me is like the huge question. It doesn't make sense that they were there. I mean, it makes sense that, you know, other hunters may have been there because, you know, they got off work at 3 and they only had this like hour and a half period. So they all ran over there or whatever. But this is not something that this guy would typically do. And so that's a huge question about the why there, why then, when that's not a place that or a time of day where typically a hunting outing would happen. Right.
For Jim Bennett. Yeah, that to me has never been answered. And that I think probably should have had more focus all along because everyone told the police, they're like, wait, Bennett was at the Fulton Gate? Like, well, after they get over the shock of his death, they're like, he was hunting at the Fulton Game area. There are multiple people in the case file who are talked to, people in knew Jim Bennett. And they're all like, I had no idea to go there. And several of them said, I talked about this hunting season and Jim Bennett told me, don't ever go to the game area. It's full of crazies. And he had some really good land to hunt on nearby, permission to hunt on it. He has parents' land. He had some friends' land. He had other friends that could, like, if he wanted to hunt somewhere, he had choices. So why go to this place that's known to be crazy crowded and farther from his house? And why leave so late in the day? It is common for people to hunt in the morning, go home, come back later and hunt for sunset. But the goal is to be some out there before sunset. You want to be out there. And if you're someone who sits and hunts, like, there before the deer notice you're there. So when they wake up and start walking around,
right,
they'll stumble right into you.
Because so as you pointed out in the first episode, deer are crepuscular, which is one of my favorite vocabulary words, by the way. I'm so glad you used it in the podcast.
And Jim Bennett's going almost at sunset to a place he's known to never go. Hmm. So why is he doing
that? Consistent with a drug deal, I think.
I agree.
That's my speculation.
I completely agree. What do you think, Anya? I know you probably don't want to speculate, but does that not sound reasonable, like a reasonable potential theory? Is that, you know, going someplace you wouldn't normally go, a place where men can meet up, you know, without being questioned, that isn't public per se, where you can have a pack on you to carry something if you want? Like, it kind of makes sense to me.
You know, if you're talking about the reasonableness standard, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, a reasonableness standard is actually very broad in terms of as far as interpretations go. So, yes, absolutely, it is reasonable to say that and to think that. I think that's a very safe answer in this case.
Isn't it also just, yeah. I mean, I hate to use this, I hate the Occam's razor analogy, but it's also so much more likely of a motive or of a reason, you know, in terms of victimology, it's just so much more likely than him being killed for being a trespasser. You know, if you look at it, the spectrum of his life, if he really is this big time dope grower and doper, as they say, which is a word literally I've never heard before this podcast, you know, wouldn't you look at the victimology and say, OK, that's the angle that we should be pursuing because that's the most likely reason that somebody may have wanted to kill him.
And it was a heavy focus for the original investigators and to a lesser degree, the cold case team because of this issue. Like at a certain point, when you have two people involved in the drug trade, one of whom's confirmed problems and the other who may have had some problems and they walk in the woods and both get killed, like it almost seems more unlikely that it's not about that. Mm-hmm. But there's all there is stuff kind of the way, too. Like I do believe that no one knew at the well, I think it's likely that no one knew at the outset where the Doug Estes party was going that day, or yeah. at least that Bobby and Mark Perry didn't. And for Bennett, we just have so many unanswered questions there, where we something that seems off and never really got explained, but also isn't impossible to square away with hunting. I think part of it was just like investigator exhaustion, or maybe I'm just projecting there, but all these crazy drug theories. And like, there's a lot you're not even hearing about because they just not going anywhere. You get tired of it. Like the Larry Moyer, the St. Joseph County investigator in the case said, like, it's a bitch.
Right. I mean, I don't think, John, I think you and I are thinking the same thing. It doesn't have to be a crazy theory. It could literally be somebody who knows a drug deal is going to go down. They know there's going to be drugs and money. And that's a great target. I mean, if you ever watched The Wire, that was Omar's job, right?
I don't know if you're planning on doing an episode about the trial, but I sure want to know why all this wasn't enough to be reasonable, to be beyond a reasonable doubt. It sure seems like there's reasonable doubt.
Well, we'll get into that, but I think part of it we kind of hinted at this episode is that it has to do with the ones the defense attorneys focused on. For instance, the decision to focus on this crazy theory from Norberto, I think was an extreme dire mistake by the defense. I don't know if they believed it personally or they thought the jury would find it believable, but juries hate to have, if you're going to put an alternate suspect forward, you better be able to bring the goods because juries hate that.
Yeah.
Like, juries turn off if they hear this unless you can prove it good. And to have this kind of crazy, unbacked up theory thrown out there, I think it could have made the jury just less receptive in general to other ideas. Like, that's the drug theory? That is some crazy BS. Let's like not even worry about it.
I do want to address one listener question from Thomas, who asks, didn't Jim Bennett supposedly tell his girlfriend that if anything happened to him, by the way, every time someone says, if something happens to me, .. like, don't say that because you are totally marking yourself for murder. OK, so back to the question. Didn't Jim Bennett supposedly tell his girlfriend that if anything happened to him, someone named Terry would be responsible? What is that all about?
This is the tape that... supposedly a cassette tape and a gun was under Jim Bennett's bed. Like a week or two before he died, he apparently placed it there and told Kimber, his living girlfriend, something happens to me, give this to the cops. And then after this all happens, Kimber and her daughter Amanda leave the house. Jim's friends come in and remove the weed for him so that the cops don't find it. And somewhere in the course of all of this, when they get back to the trailer, this cassette tape and the gun are both gone. And all Kimber knows is that he said that Jim Bennett told her has something to do with Terry. On the other hand, like, I think one in three men down there are named Terry. Just for my, like...
Speaking of Terry, what's Terry Ash's alibi?
He didn't have one. Doesn't have one. Not at all.
All right.
No
so
idea.
So who are the people that don't have alibis that... you think a listener should consider putting in the frame? I mean, you told me you don't think Bobby Brown is responsible. And
okay.
He was
y'all want a crazy theory? So all we know of Terry Ash's night is he was at the bar when a guy named Lafleur came and told him that Jim was dead. Now, this is going to be, okay, it's getting off the wall. Lafleur lived near the Fulton State Game area. He knew Jim Bennett. He had a brother who was... about 10 years before, there had been a situation where there's a hitman, basically. A guy got his friend Lafleur to kill his wife. The guy goes to prison. Lafleur got acquitted.
What?
Lafleur's brother, actually. And there was a guy that he'd borrowed the car. Lafleur, the hitman Lafleur, had borrowed a friend's car to drive it there to do this job. And another guy was his alibi. And somehow, again, acquitted. The guy who hired him to kill his ex-wife, he went to prison and then escaped. I don't know what happened after that. But Lafleur got acquitted. And we get here to, you know, 1990. This guy, his brother is there, knows way too much about the case way too early on. Lafleur's alibi is the same alibi he had, same guy as the alibi that he had for the last time around.
Huh.
And the guy who he borrowed the car from that wasn't, you know, says that, oh, Lafleur borrowed my car to commit this murder. That guy is later getting drunk around town saying, I know who did it. I know who did it.
Oh.
And then naming people in the circle. And I have nothing to say any of that has anything to do with anything. Except for the fact that it's really weird. And none of them have alibis that make any sense.
Right. Huh. You need to put together like a Carrie Matheson style board.
That it would just be red. It would just be red string everywhere.
You guys need like a video segment, you know, have that. It's kind of 538 does that, right? They video their podcast and they record it. And then you can actually use the video. Visuals here would have been extremely gratifying, you know,
tell. Yeah. Yeah, or like just like a Facebook, like a who's who. Like, I mean, I just the fact that you said half of people were named Terry, I'm very glad to hear you say that because I just in talking to you about the case, I'm like that Terry. No, the other how many like Terry? I guess is a common name there.
So there is one. There's a group in this case. There's three brothers that are Terrence, Lawrence, and Gerald. But of course, they all go by Terry, Larry, and Jerry. So trying to keep that straight.
So I want to come back to you for a second, John and Anya. It's extremely hard to seek damages against police officers for constitutional violations that result in wrongful convictions. But we hear a lot about prosecutors who violate the Constitution all the time. How hard is it to hold a prosecutor to account? Anya, can you start that with that answer?
Sure. It's extremely difficult if the prosecutor acted in their prosecutorial capacity, right? And I know it's super legalese, but really the basics of it are prosecutors, just like any other government worker, are protected by qualified immunity. That's the lowest level of protection they have, if you can believe it, right? Because qualified immunity is incredibly hard to overcome. But then if these prosecutors acted not in their administrative capacity, say hiring or firing people, but if they were acting in their prosecutorial capacity, like, I don't know, talking to witnesses or, you know, doing sort of this kind of any of this type of stuff, then they are protected by absolute immunity. And if they lie through their teeth, if they threaten, if they do all kinds of horrible stuff, there is nothing you can do. And even, you know, the qualified immunity standard is even lower than the prosecutorial immunity standard that those guys get. So that's definitely, we're going to talk about it on Bound by Oath, but it's definitely a very, very, it's essentially impossible to overcome.
John, have you written about any cases where this was addressed?
What's a good case? So I guess the quick and dirty explanation is that once the trial starts, you get absolute immunity. But prosecutors do all kinds of things before a trial starts to if they intimidate a witness in a certain way or do kind of like investigation, then they're only entitled to qualified immunity. So there's a big case in the Fifth Circuit right now where prosecutors in New Orleans were printing out fake subpoenas and giving them to potential witnesses in cases and saying, you have to come in and talk to us or we're going to throw you in jail. But I mean, it was a fake piece of paper. A judge had never signed off on it. They do not get absolute immunity for that. So that case is going to continue. I don't know what the status of it is, if it's back in the trial court going to trial or if they now have to fight about qualified immunity. I'd have to look that up. But absolute immunity is not available for that particular prosecutorial misconduct.
The bottom line is you're in trouble, right? When qualified immunity, you know it's really hard to sue a government worker if qualified immunity is something you're fighting for them to fight over, right? You basically saying, and that was the argument in the Fifth Circuit. It's like these guys were saying, please, please, please let us tell you why qualified immunity doesn't apply, right? Like, let's fight about qualified immunity. Please just give us a chance to do that. Because the other one, the prosecutorial immunity, you just don't even get even the slightest of hopes. So that kind of gives you an idea of where the state of the law is when it comes to prosecutors.
And for wrongful conviction cases, you're going to have absolute immunity apply. The prosecutor's acting as a prosecutor when they're doing Brady violations. So there is no go there. Sometimes you might be able to bring a suit against the officers involved, but the prosecutor is going to be off limits. In fact, there was a striking case, striking because it never happens, where recently a prosecutor had a consequence for rampant Brady violations. There was a New York DA who had his license suspended for 2 years for his laundry list of Brady violations in a homicide case. And that is a very rare victory.
You had to like go out of your way to like come up. Innocence Project, I think, was in charge of this case, right? They had to go out of their way to come up with a particular way of even holding him somewhat to account. But there isn't the question of being able to sue him for damages for violations of constitutional rights. You can't do that. It's just more, oh, at least he's, you know, doesn't have a license for 2 years. That's the best you can come up with.
For a prosecutor, a 2-year loss of your like license to your job is like the equivalent of winning like a $100 million lawsuit. Like that's as good as it gets to an extreme degree.
Right.
Yeah, but there's no remedy there for the person whose rights were violated at all.
No.
Exactly.
Yeah.
John Ross, where can listeners check out the Bound by Oath podcast, including me? I know that I want to subscribe immediately.
All fine podcasting apps. Just search for Bound by Oath. The image is a judge being sworn in. You can just see his hand being raised, or hers, I guess. It's just a hand.
No, and you know, one of the things you guys are talking about, kind of like, if you like a similar setting, like ranch, a lot of land, zoning stuff, we actually have that too in our podcast. Episode 2 of season 2, we talk about Wilkie versus Robbins, and that's when a rancher tried to hold land Bureau of Land Management.
The original BLM.
Yeah. Because they were trying to essentially, go on his land and have some serious zoning stuff, and they were intimidating him. And it's a story about this rancher in Wyoming trying to get them to stop harassing him.
Hmm. Yeah, an Alabaman moved to Wyoming to rustle some cattle and pissed off the local BLM, but turned out to be more cussed than they were.
Wow. Well, John Ross, producer of Bound by Oath, I can't wait to listen to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining
us. Anya's co-producer too.
Well, I'm about to give her credit for
great.
That.
Don't forget Anya. She's the lawyer. She's the one to make sure it's all right.
Well, I was going to say, Anya Bidwell, you're co-producer of the podcast, but you're also continuing to fight the good fight and your fellowship and your lifetime of work. Thank you so much for talking with me. It was a pleasure to meet both of you.
Great meeting you, and thanks for having us.
And of course, Susan Simpson, thank you so much for talking to me more about the Titus case and about all the other areas we're able to fill in with your extensive, outrageous knowledge of things that make me incredibly angry. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I'm sad that your dogs didn't join us this time.
And if you're interested in hearing another podcast about accountability and policing, check out NHPR's podcast, Document the List. It's made by my day job colleagues, and it is outstanding. Thanks so much for listening. We will be back next week with more Undisclosed and Addendum. If you have questions or tips about the case, you can email undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or send them to us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is everywhere at Undisclosed Pod. Audio production of the Addendum is done by Hannah McCarthy. The executive producer of Undisclosed is Methil Telhan. Follow the show everywhere on social at Undisclosed Pod. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast, Crime Writers On. For everyone here at Undisclosed, have a great week. We'll catch you next time.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong. The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer.
Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.